The song you just heard was by a duet, McCoy Tyner on piano, Bobby Hutcherson on vibes. McCoy Tyner, one of the great jazz pianists, played on most of John Coltrane's records in the early mid-60s. He passed away in 2020. I think Bobby Hutcherson is still with us. I should do a little bit more research if I can start saying things like that. And before that, we heard from Tony Allen, the Nigerian drummer and band leader who passed away in 2020. The name of that track was Aria. I hope I'm saying that right. That was off one of the best CDs that Tony Allen did, as far as I'm concerned, Black Voices. Okay, that's going to do it for us in Pinckney Hall today. Next week, I'm not sure what we're doing. We might do people that passed away in 2021. That's what I was going to do, but just before going on air, I learned that the Grand Prospect Hall is being torn down, and that has bad consequences musically. We might have to play Balkan brass band music in honor of that. In any case, we'll guarantee you an interesting hour next week. It is 6 o'clock. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. Thanks for tuning in.
I want you to listen carefully. Rick and I will be returning to the studio to record new programs soon. I know a lot of you have been listening to the same programs for the past few months now, but we're going to be returning to the studio soon with some new programming. But let's go back in the archives again and listen to this very important program here on Ebony Spectrum, and you'll be really surprised and shocked on what you hear.
All right. We have on the line, we have a caller. He's calling from Texas. But first, I want to do some background on this next guest. We are talking about what happened at Volkswagen, at the Volkswagen plant in New Stanton, PA, back in the 70s. We're revisiting this, and the reason why we're revisiting this is because the son of Mr. William B. Brock wants folks to be aware of what happened to his father as a result of being part of all that at Volkswagen. Let me give you a little bit of background, then we'll have T.W. On the line with us. William B. Brock was recruited by Volkswagen as Equal Employment Opportunity Administrator in the personnel office of the Westmoreland plant in New Stanton in July of 1977. Now, according to the court documents, Mr. Brock was assured that he'd be responsible for the development and implementation of corporate efforts to employ blacks while ensuring the full compliance of equal rights and equal employment opportunity laws in the operation of the Volkswagen plant in New Stanton, Pennsylvania. Court documents also indicated that Volkswagen undertook public and private surveillance of Mr. Brock, including electronic surveillance and monitoring of the business, social, and personal activities of Mr. Brock. And in addition, Volkswagen communicated threats to the life and safety of Mr. Brock and his family and fabricating not only false and groundless information while threatening the public to defame Mr. Brock's character based on that. Now, Mr. Brock was the president of the Washington, PA NAACP. He was also running for mayor of Washington, PA. So without any further delay, we're going to bring T.W. on the line with us here at WRCT. Hey, T.W.
I'm here, brother. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing well, man. I'm doing real well. Thank you for asking.
I just wanted to give a little bit of a background so people will be aware of what we're talking about. A lot of people aren't familiar with what happened at Volkswagen, either because they may be too young or that just thing just escapes their memory. But I wanted to bring this back to people's knowledge, and also we can direct people to the website, where they can get all the information that they need. So we would really appreciate you taking some time out of your busy schedule to be with us on the air today. Now, we want to introduce you. We'll have you back more to talk more about this case. But I want to get you on today to lay a groundwork. So help me finish laying the groundwork to what happened to your father.
Absolutely. First off, to the listening audience, my name is T.W. Brock. I'm William Bryant Brock's oldest son. Most people aren't aware of me, but that actually works out to my advantage, believe it or not, because many people are under the impression that my father committed suicide. He did not. He was actually recruited by Volkswagen back in July of 1977. The company sent a limo to his job, took him to dinner, and made him a job offer. They hired him specifically to ease the racial tension at that former plant in New Stanton, Pennsylvania. So when my father initially came on board, he came on board as the EEOC coordinator, meaning he was a hiring, firing director. So initially, my father began hiring from the minority community. And then the company tells him flat out, don't worry about the other blacks. We're going to take real good care of you. So they really hired my father to be a token so that they could say, see, look, we hired black folk. Now leave us alone. But I need you guys to understand that my father was a man of integrity. You see, prior to going to work for them, he worked out in Washington County as at the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission. So he hired the people for the police department and city jobs. So he was well aware of the employment laws. Therefore, there was really nothing they could do about his hiring practices. And back in those days, they didn't have what you call at-will states where your employer can fire you at will. So you had to have a paper trail to fire someone. So then the company called themselves promoting him to a position they thought he couldn't handle because he continued to hire from the minority community. So they promoted him to shipping coordinator, which means his new job was to map out the cheapest route to get the product from the plant to the different dealers in the United States. I guess they figured a 27-year-old with no training in that area wouldn't do too well. But if they had done their homework prior to promoting him, they would have discovered that my father taught probability and statistics in college as a hobby. And he was very intelligent. So he actually ended up saving the company several $1 million a month. And that got him featured in all your major magazines, the Wall Street Journal, the Boston Globe, the New York Times, the Philadelphia Inquirer, Jet, Ebony. So the Germans overseas loved my father. They gave him a private jet to fly him back and forth to Germany, a company car, and three secretaries when he was 27 years old. He actually wrote speeches for the vice president of the entire company when he was just 27. So then the blacks at the plant formed a caucus and made my father president and spokesperson. And while he was negotiating for the company to make concessions for other minorities, you know, things like better positions, more money, less discrimination, the company would agree to certain terms behind closed doors. But then when my father would call a general meeting with the rest of the caucus members, the company would deny those terms. We didn't say that. That's not true. And it's been my experience, my unfortunate experience, that as a people, we typically have a hard time sticking together. So the other blacks at that point called my father a sellout and everything else. But my thing is, if we think about it for a moment, if my father were a sellout, please answer me one question. How in the world did we get hired at a company that wasn't hiring black folk in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
But I think we don't think. So the other minorities went behind my father's back and filed a $70 million class action discrimination lawsuit against the automaker. When they made that move, it actually caused panic among upper management because my father originally worked in personnel. When he worked in personnel, he wrote the company's equal employment opportunity policy. In addition, he was the president of the NAACP in Washington County, Pennsylvania, and he was running for mayor. So he knew where the company was breaking the law. Therefore, he had enough information to put them out of business in the U.S., and a lot of people aren't aware of that. And a lot of people are also aren't aware of the fact that the company owns Volkswagen, Audi, Porsche, Lamborghini, Bentley, Bugatti. That's a $19.5 million automobile. Ducati, the motorcycle company, and even owns shares in Suzuki. So had the minorities succeeded in putting the company out of business in the U.S., it would have cost the company trillions of dollars. So don't take my word for it, because court documents indicated the company tried to blackmail my father
with knowingly false information in an effort to convince him to coerce the other blacks to back out of the lawsuit. That move actually had the opposite effect. It pissed him off, and he joined the lawsuit with the other minorities. And just a few hours after he joined the lawsuit, the New York Times says he went home and shot himself. The New York Times failed to mention that my father was left-handed. He was shot with a .38 pistol with an 8-inch barrel in the back of the right side of his head. That's not physically possible to do. When I asked Dr. Cyril Wex, and most of us in Pittsburgh know who he is, Dr. Wex is one of the best pathologists in the country. He worked on the O.J. Simpson case, the Kennedy case, and Nicole Smith, Whitney Houston. When I asked him, has he ever dealt with suicide? He said, of course. So I asked him, I said, where do people generally tend to shoot themselves? He said, men shoot themselves in the mouth, under the chin, or in the temple. Women typically tend to shoot themselves in the heart because they want an open casket funeral. When I asked him, has he ever dealt with a suicide case where a left-handed man shoots himself in the back of the right side of the head? He said, no. He asked me at that point, what did the coroner's inquest say? When I explained to Dr. Weck that there was no inquest. There was, however, a report, but there was no inquest. He said to me that that sounds like foul play. There was also an alleged suicide note found near my father's body. I had that note analyzed by the same guy who analyzed the Zodiac killer's writing. He's willing to prove in court it was forged. Got to get to court first. Because my father's death certificate says suicide, no one wants to take the case. Everyone's afraid. Even to this date, you know, there are people who used to work at Volkswagen with my father, some of his old employees who worked under him and with him. They're afraid to talk about it to date. I've been told, even when I put together the website, when I went to them for help to get information, detailed information to put on the website, I was told by his former employees, I can't help you because I got a family. If he committed suicide, why are you afraid to talk about it?
So apparently Volkswagen has paid off all those folks that worked for your father.
I don't think they paid them off. I don't agree with that. I do believe that they were in fear for their own lives because of the many threats that they received over the years. I believe that that my father's death and his murder was a scare tactic. I myself, when I spoke with Bird Brown, who was the former attorney for the Black Caucus, I was doing some digging into my father's death. And Bird Brown told me, you better leave this case alone before what happened to your father happens to you. And I said, well, I'm not going to commit suicide. And he said, you and I both know your father didn't commit suicide. Well, my thing is, if he knew that my father didn't commit suicide, why didn't he do something about it?
Very interesting. Now, I know some of the things that came up in the lawsuit. A lot of the black workers at the time, and my brother was one of those black workers who was working at New Stanton at Volkswagen. They were being harassed. There was things like nooses put up on people's lockers, black baby dolls placed in people's lockers. Sometimes people's cars were vandalized and all kinds of different things were going on at the time at the Volkswagen plant in New Stanton.
That sounds like several things going on.
Yeah, there was a lot of things going on. Now, what really brought my attention to this, and knowing that Volkswagen went through all this effort to, silent people, that they just settled for, I think, another trillions of dollars in this whole emissions case that stems from the cars being manufactured here in the United States.
Where they lied.
Where they lied about the emissions.
Right. I think that was about 2 or 3 late years ago.
No, they just settled the case this year.
Oh, made a career, huh? Because I've been hearing about them having issues with their emissions and how that was also tied into the odometer.
So a lot of these things happen with these cars that were being manufactured here in the United States. Your father was a very popular popular man and well-known, being on the State Human Relations Commission, head of the NAACP there in Washington, PA, and also running for mayor of Washington, PA, which was kind of unheard of back then, back there in the 70s. And Washington County has, like, grown tremendously since then. GW?
Oh yeah, I'm still here. Yeah. I'm listening to you.
I'm just.
It was one day. It was funny. I was in a 7-Eleven store in Washington County myself,
mm-hmm.
and this police officer was. This guy's staring me down. He's a Washington County police officer, and so I asked him. I said, "Is there a problem? I mean, have I done something to offend you, officer?" And he says, "No, you look like." And I said, "Bill Brock." He said, "Yes." I said, "That was my father." He said, "But your father hired me. He did not commit suicide."
Wow.
You know, there are so many discrepancies with regards to my father's murder that it's unreal. There was an alleged suicide note, again, found near his body. I had the note analyzed. And the gentleman who analyzed it is the same guy who analyzed the Zodiac killers, right?
Right.
He's willing to prove in court it was forged. Got to get to court. Some years ago, because I had sent... 3 or 4 Freedom of Information Act requests to the Washington County Police Department for them to release the statement of what took place on that particular night. And they wouldn't release it to me. So I contacted the state police, and I shared my story with one of the state police officers. And he says, I gave him my contact number so he could follow up with me. And he says, "Give me a couple of days to look into it. I'm going to get back to you because it definitely doesn't sound right." So he begins looking into it, and he calls me back a couple of days later. He says, "Man, this case is deeper than you think. Your dad definitely didn't commit suicide. We're going to get to the bottom of this." So he gave me his personal number and said, "You make sure you stay on top of me." So 2 days turns into too long. I hadn't heard from the guy, so because he told me, he's going to stay in touch with me. And so I got angry, and I called the colonel of the Pennsylvania State Police. At the time, the colonel's name was Colonel Miller. So I contacted Colonel Miller, and Colonel Miller says, "Well, give me a couple of days to look into it. I'll get back to you." So Colonel Miller calls me back a few days later, and he says, "I can't help you because this case is out of our jurisdiction." I said, "Wait a minute now. You're the Pennsylvania State Police. There is no jurisdiction within the state of Pennsylvania that's outside of your jurisdiction." He said to me, "Sir," he was a bit more firm at this point, "I can't help you with this case." I said, "Okay, let me get this. I just want to be sure that we're straight and we're on the same page." I said, "So if I went to a state police and you're in that neck of the woods where this took place and I put a gun to the back of his head and pulled the trigger, are you telling me you couldn't arrest me because it's outside of your jurisdiction?" And Colonel Miller said, "Sir, I can't help you with this case." And he hung up the phone to me. What that suggested to me was someone above his head told him to leave it alone.
Yeah. So what can people do, first of all, TW, to be aware of this case and to help you change some of this around?
I think some of the things that we can do, if you go on the website is www.justice, that's J-U-S-T-I-C-E, the word for, which is F-O-R, Brock, B-R-O-C-K, justiceforbrock.com. On the webpage in the upper right-hand corner, there's a blue link that says you can help by sending this letter to your congressman. So you don't even have to write the letter. It's already pre-written for you.
Mm.
Currently, what one has to do is print it out, sign it, date it, add their congressman's name, and if they don't know who their congressmen are, there's a link beneath it. Click here to find your congressman. It'll take you to Congress's website. You plug in your zip code, it'll tell you who your congressman is, okay? It'll give you their name and contact information. At this point, we're asking that you fax the letter to them, not mail it, because if they mail it, they can always say, "Well, I never received it." When it's faxed to the congressman, we get a confirmation number immediately from their fax machine notifying you that it's been sent. At current, where I'm working on a database, so where people will just be able, instead of printing it out, they can just go online and click the button, and they can do an e-signature. But at current, I don't have that available, so the steps are a little bit more lengthy. Once the letter's been faxed, I'm asking that you return to the website or return and send us an email at info@justiceforbrock.com, giving us your first and last name, your full address, and the date you sent the letter, and what number it was sent to. And then your name, if you look on the Our Supporter page, will be added to the page. Now, I'm not going to add your full address to that corporate to our supporter page. What I will add is your first and last name and the city and state that you reside in and the date you sent it and the number it was sent, the congressman it was sent to. And the reason why we're doing it that way is this is our way of holding our congressmen accountable to the letters that they're receiving from us.
I've got a question.
That letter is asking our congressman to get the Justice Department involved.
I've got a question for you. I'm thinking that, okay, your father was the president of the NAACP. Did National ever get involved? The National NAACP?
They have not. They have not. You wouldn't believe some of the steps that we've taken over the years to get different agencies involved, but it's been my unfortunate experience that I'm not getting the involvement that I'm seeking at this time. Maybe with more people pushing those buttons, maybe I can get some help.
I was thinking that's a great question.
But currently, I'm one man going up against a mega organization, yes. And I'm just a small guy.
Yeah, Denise asked a great question, and I got to thinking, okay, we need a bigger platform, a bigger voice.
You know, maybe we.
And you know who comes to mind? A former NAACP person on the national board, and president of a chapter, and very well known. And that would be in the person of.
But I have reached out. I have reached out on different occasions to different organizations. Hell, I've even reached out to Al Sharpton to no avail.
Well, how about Joe Madison? Joe was just named to the Radio Hall of Fame. I believe he was head of the Detroit NAACP. He and Dick Gregory were great friends and got arrested regularly outside the CIA and FBI around the crack cocaine conspiracy. And Madison got involved with slavery in the Sudan. And so he has a huge microphone. He's on Sirius Radio. Let's see, that would be 126.
Sirius Radio, TW. That's another
Sirius XM satellite radio.
Joe Madison.
Right. And another.
And thing. I'll forward something to him. I mean, if he would get involved in one, do the story. I mean, he has literally millions of people that listen to his show because of that satellite connection. If you know about the station, you can get awesome. It if you've gotten that in your car. And he comes on 6 to 10 every morning, Monday through Friday. He's an NAACP person. So, you know, that rang a bell there. Because I'm just thinking, I mean, I'm just like, I'm. Those who know me, I'm rarely speechless.
This is very true.
The story that you have relayed, I'm like, you know, I don't want to be profane and just cuss or anything. But I was just like, what?
Dang.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, here's something else I just thought about, too. The power of the black press. I'm thinking that if you were to get in contact with someone at the New Pittsburgh Courier, and they are a member of the National Newspaper Publisher Association, which is basically all of the black newspapers in the country,
yeah.
If they do the story, there's a very high probability that we'll be picked up by NNPA and, you know, go all over the place. And then also getting, what's that boy's name up there in New York? Sean something.
Oh, yeah, I know you're talking about.
Right. He's got a...
Does anyone have access to the internet while we're on this call?
Yeah, should be able to.
Let's see if we can get it here.
Okay. I'd like you to pull up the website. I'd like to show you something. With regards to the Pittsburgh Post, the Pittsburgh Courier, I've actually reached out to them on a couple of occasions. To no avail. I've even asked them for different articles related to this,
this story, and they refused to release that information.
Yes, in their archives somewhere, and you have to pay to get in there.
Right, and the archives are no longer in Pittsburgh. They're up at the parent company in Detroit.
That's my point. And it's not like, you know, it's been my experience that they haven't been as open to the idea to help, you know, bring this story back to fruition. So please, if you have access to the internet, and your and any of your viewers or sorry, your listeners are listening to this call at the moment, and you have access to the internet, go to www.justiceforbrock.com, and there's a picture of a vehicle right there on the homepage. Just beneath that picture, there's a link that says "A decision at VW, then suicide." That's an article from the Pittsburgh Courier. On the second page of that article, in the center column, there are three columns on the second page.
Mm-hmm.
In the center column, about four paragraphs in, it says, after Brock's reunion with Penn on Friday, the men talked about their experiences at Volkswagen and why, after more than a year of negotiations that appear to be bearing fruit, a lawsuit was filed. It reads, Penn pulled a picture from a large folder filled with hate literature he said was found at the plant. The picture was of a bomb that turned out to be fake, which nonetheless chilled both him and his family. The bomb was found in his desk drawer at work in November. Later, a telephone caller said, hey, N-word, next time it'll be a real one. Why is it that we can tear the internet apart, but this newspaper article cannot be found anywhere else online today but this website?
Also, there's some things in the Pittsburgh Press Archives, which is on the UPI Facebook page, which I was able to pull up an article about New Stanton from the UPI, United Press International, which was the parent company of the Pittsburgh Press at one time, that had information about the case as well.
Right.
It's hard to find those press articles as well. But I've reached out to many different people. Some of them may be listening right now, listening to the program. Hopefully you'll follow up with this when you go on the air. And, you know, we're just going to continue getting this information out there. We need to go and have them change what's on your father's death certificate, you know, to homicide and not suicide.
Exactly.
That mm-hmm. needs to be done. All you Peabody Highlanders that are listening, all you people from the University of Pittsburgh, all you folks from Kappa Alpha Psi, y'all need to like get on this and help your brother out. And
I'm on the page.
And turn this information.
And the National Newspaper Publishers Association.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know Dr. Chavis,
mm-hmm.
and let's get a message to him.
Yes.
He's the president for the whole association.
So we will continue on with
and
this.
And Madison should know us. We used to meet him in Washington every great March, back when he was fat. He didn't lose a lot of weight. And then finally, what's really startling to me, I didn't know, but I know your dad. When I looked at the picture, I said, I know him. So, you know, NAACP, whatever.
I'd like to share with you one other piece of information.
Okay. Real quick, TW, because we have to go. Okay.
Oh, understood.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. The last thing that I'd like to share, if your listeners go to on the web page, there's a link that says threats. It's on the home page.
Okay.
It's actually on company letterhead. Okay. On the second page of the second paragraph, the last three sentences on that second paragraph on the second page, it's on company letterhead, mind you, says, in fact, you commented that if this thing appears in the press, what can we do if, say, Charlie Scales, that was one of my father's employees, was found dead with a bullet through the heart in the back of the plant? On the third page, you'll see the letter itself was CC'd to the U.S. Justice Department, the U.S. EEOC, James Short, who was then the vice president of Volkswagen, Dr. Carl Hahn, who was then the president of Volkswagen, Bert Brown, who was the attorney for the VW Black Caucus,
Yet there are court documents and newspaper articles that say Volkswagen categorically denied threatening him. Please tell me how they got away with categorically denying a threat. In court documents, when you've got a copy of a threat on company letterhead, CC to the U.S. Justice Department.
Okay. T.W.
We'll follow
it's
up.
Called cover-up.
T.W., we're going to have you back. I will talk to you probably later today or tomorrow sometime. And I just wanted to get things started, and thank you for taking some time out to come on the air with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. Be well, brother. All right. That's it for Ebony Spectrum this week. We'll see you next week, same time, same place. Be safe. Can't be right, be left.
You are listening to a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. Any opinions expressed within are solely those of the participants and do not reflect the views of WRCT Radio Incorporated. Questions and comments can be addressed to the Public Affairs Director at pa@wrct.org or by calling 412-621-0728.
Mr. Chairman, and to the Credentials Committee, my name is Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer, and I live at 626 East Lafayette Street, Roseville, Mississippi, Sunflower County, the home of Senator James O. Eastland and Senator Stennis. It was the 31st of August in 1962 that 18 of us traveled 26 miles to the county courthouse in Indianola to try to register to become first-class citizens. We was met in Indianola by policemen, highway patrolmen, and they only allowed two of us in to take the literacy test at the time. After we had taken this test and started back to Roseville, we was held up by the city police and the state highway patrolmen and carried back to Indianola, where the bus driver was charged that day with driving a bus the wrong color. After we paid the fine among us, we continued on to Roseville. And Reverend Jeff Sonny carried me 4 miles in the rural area where I had worked as a timekeeper and sharecropper for 18 years. I was met there by my children that told me the plantation owner was angry because I had gone down, tried to register. After they told me, my husband came and said the plantation owner was raising cane because I had tried to register. And before he quit talking, the plantation owner came and said, Fannie Lou, do you know, did Pap tell you what I said? And I said, yes, sir. He said, well, I mean that, said, if you don't go down and withdraw your registration, you will have to leave. Said, then if you go down and withdraw, that you still might have to go because we're not ready for that in Mississippi. And I addressed him and told him that I didn't try to register for you. I tried to register for myself. I had to leave that same night. All of this is on account of we want to register to become first-class citizens. And if the Freedom Democratic Party is not seated now, I question America. Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off of the hook because our lives be threatened daily because we want to live as decent human beings in America? Thank you.
Hey, out there in Radio Land, you are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 on your radio device, WRCT.org on your web device. It is 7 o'clock. That means it is time for the radio calendar. Here are some things going on around Pittsburgh. The 820 Liberty Gallery is showing Simply Divine, a retrospective of Danny Divine, showcasing thought-provoking, uplifting, joyful, and playful works created by the late Pittsburgh native. Danny Divine was a graffiti writer, muralist, photographer, printmaker, painter, and mentor. The exhibit is on display now through June 12th at 820 Liberty Avenue in downtown Pittsburgh. For more information about the Pittsburgh Cultural Trust Galleries, go to trustarts.org. While we're on the art exhibit theme of one, now two, the Cranberry Artists Network presents their first exhibition of the season, entitled A View from Above or Below. Curated by Mike Panza, the owner of Panza Gallery in Millvale, the works will feature the artist's unique perspective on the world when seen from unusual angles. A View from Above or Below will be shown at the Cranberry Township Municipal Center at 2525 Rochester Road in Cranberry Township from now until April 14th. For more information, visit cranberryartistsnetwork.com. And finally, you can stop by the Pittsburgh Banjo Club's regular rehearsal every Wednesday at 8 p.m. and enjoy their wonderful music. Enjoy it! Food and refreshments are available. Founded in 1988, the Pittsburgh Banjo Club is an all-volunteer band and organization that uses banjos, trumpets, tubas, and bass to perform popular music from the 1920s and the 1930s. The Banjo Club rehearses at the Allegheny Elks Lodge, number 339, which is at 400 Cedar Avenue in Pittsburgh's North Side. Reservations must be made by Tuesday at 5 p.m. for each Wednesday event. Call 412-321-1834 to do so, or for more information in general. Moving on to other live music you can see around the city. Some of it you don't need a reservation for. Tonight at Stage AE, you can catch St. Paul and the Broken Bones, along with the Sacred Souls. The Bachelor Boys Band will be at Kingfly Spirits. The Dangerous Summer will be at Craft House, along with Corey Wells and the Birkin. Steel Mill Rising will be at Jurgles. Jukebox the Ghost will be at Mr. Small's, along with Olivia Klugman. And The Midnight will be at the Roxian. Not Midnight, but The Midnight will be at the Roxian, along with Nightly. I could see how you could be surprised. Tomorrow night, Ritz will be at the Craft House, along with Greaves and Triz. Blink is at Kingfly Spirits. Rex Tycoon will be at the Roboto Project, along with Wasted Space, Psych Ward Grips, and Frog Legs. Knucklepuck is playing Mr. Smalls, along with Hot Mulligan, Meet Me at the Altar, and Anxious. Garcia Peoples is at the Club Cafe along with Doug Shaw. The Windups will be at the Government Center along with Minima and Bloomfield Pest Control. The Lax are at Jurgles, and Thunderbird is hosting St. Patty's with Sex Brews and Trailheads and Giovanni Orsini. On Friday, the Dwellingtons will be at Preserving Underground along with Prosperity Gospel, Tempered, the Book Club, Plum Bob, the Head Trips, and On Your Nerves. That starts at 6 p.m. and is apparently going to run forever. Vanner will be at Jurgles. The Manchester Orchestra will be at the Roxian, along with Foxing and Michigander. Co Wetzel is at Stage 8.